Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. I know my brother was the person who taught me how to drive, but it involved no winter driving. Driving on ice and snow, I had to learn on my own, and I'm still not sure how good I am at that. I'd say I'm a pretty good driver, but like everyone, I've had my moments of stupidity. I've been driving for 43 years and have had only 3 minor accidents, but again, I'll say I'm not sure if I'm a good winter driver. Most of us learn while doing, and that can be pretty scary. So I'll take every opportunity to speak with people who really know what they're doing, whatever I can learn, some tip that might help me on some icy morning in January or a snowy night in March. Today I've enlisted 2 of the Vermont Agency of Transportation's finest. Tracy Pack is a general maintenance manager for VTrans. And Tracy, great to have you with us this morning.
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, fabulous. Thank you for being here. Todd Law is the director of the Maintenance Bureau. And Todd, thanks to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
All right. Great to have you. Listeners, if you have questions about winter driving or you want to share something you've picked up along the way, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tracy, I'm going to start with you. How much do you like driving in the snow?
More than other people, but it's always a interesting situation.
why do you enjoy it a little more than most people?
Well, it's always been a part of what I've done for the last 20 years. So it's just kind of another day in in the field.
Well, that's right. That's kind of your office, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm actually work in the office more.
I understand.
I used to volunteer to plow and go out and drive around in it. It's pretty fun and interesting.
Yep. Todd, do you think people get the proper training to be ready to handle winter driving?
Honestly, I think a lot of it's on the job training. So, we all think, we're in the Northeast. We know how to drive the ice and snow. First few storms are usually a little more difficult for everybody because we've lost the practice. We don't think ahead. Honestly, I think the roads tend to be a little more difficult because they're warm, things melt, it ices up. And nobody thinks about that when they're looking at snow coming out of the sky. So, those tests are usually on-the-job training for all of us. So,
is there anything we should do, let's say mid-October, to early November, other than, getting winter tires put on, but to kind of mentally prepare ourselves, Todd, before we have that first snowfall that starts to wreak havoc out there?
I think the biggest thing is, making sure that we start watching the weather. A lot of times, earlier in the year, we're watching the weather to see when we should have trips or whatever, or go to the beach or whatever. But, this one is more for preparation on giving yourself extra time so you can get to and from someplace by slowing down and getting there safely. And then looking at our 511 website that gives a lot of information with the cameras that show some of the road conditions and seeing what's happening out there. A lot of those social media platforms and all the the ways and everything that shows you what's happening out on the roads. But of course, preparation of your vehicle is first and foremost, making sure that it's ready for winter, that you've had it properly serviced so it can get you to and from, and like you said, the snow tires and there's a lot of things that, I think AAA has a really good website that talks to those things and on how to prepare your vehicle. But, making sure that mentally we're prepared, that when the snow's coming out of the sky, making sure you have that extra time to get to and from safely.
That's a brilliant idea. I love the idea of making sure you're checking the weather, checking the 511 website to see if you do need to leave extra time, even if it means getting out to your car 5 or 10 minutes early to clean it off, because that's going to factor in to your quote-unquote drive time, and you don't want to try to make it up once you're out on the highways. Tracy, Todd was talking about preparing your vehicle for the winter driving slog. What are some things we should be doing in that regard?
Well, you know, I agree with everything that Todd said. There are some other things that we should also look at. We should make sure that our headlights are at, you know, full capacity. If they're getting dim, have them replaced or replace them yourselves. Windshield wipers should, you know, probably be new or relatively new at the beginning of the winter season. You don't want to have to deal with, you know, the streaking when you're following behind another vehicle and it's kicking up, you know, road spray. You should also make sure that your windshield, the wiper fluid is full as well. And it's not a bad idea just to keep a spare in the vehicle because you do go through it a lot faster. And another thing that winter driving drivers should do is get a go bag together. Bring it in with you every night when you go in. Have a couple of bottles of water in there, some snacks, a blanket, a spare pair of gloves. If you don't wear boots to work, throw a pair of boots in there as well. You know, a reusable grocery bag is a great tote to do that. They're designed to stand up in the vehicle. This could save your life or certainly make make your situation a little more comfortable if you were to go off the road. A lot of times when we have road conditions that, you know, where we have multiple vehicles off the road, the tow truck driver may not get to you for several hours. So having those little things in there to help you out could really, it could save your life, or it certainly would make it a lot more pleasant in your stay.
And Tracy, why am I bringing the go bag in every night and taking it back out to my car in the morning?
So if you leave it in your car and the water freezes, it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't help you out in a situation where you need, you know, water. Also, putting on cold boots on cold feet, they're not really going to warm up. Cold gloves. You know, you want that those gloves and that blanket and your boots and your water to all be at least warmer than freezing temperatures.
Yeah. Todd, you mentioned early in the season is dangerous, but what are other dangerous times to drive in the winter?
Yeah, I think any time we're getting precipitation, specifically with freezing rain and icing events, those are the most problematic for anybody on the road crews. We throw salt out to try to melt off the ice and more piles on and it just washes away. So those icing events are very, very problematic for everybody and make for very unsafe roads. Cause no matter what we do, it's a futile effort. We throw out sand, it gets covered up and iced over. So, you know, those are the ones that are the most difficult, but anytime it's snowing, you know, we have an hour and a half to 2 hour routes. So whatever falls on the road is going to start accumulating. So, you know, again, it's not going to be, you know, the speed limit 65 miles an hour on the interstate. We would expect our customers to slow down and again, be partners with us in safety. You know, we're going to be out there clearing things off the best we can with our resources, but you know, slow down, give yourself additional distance, brake early and don't slam on the brakes. Don't use cruise control, focus on the roads, you know, all those things. Look for those pockets of, you know, our drivers understand the pockets of problematic areas where there's cold spots or whatever. So, you know, understanding that in the route, especially if it's one that you take every day, you know, is always helpful for everybody. And of course, you know, don't crowd the plow. Our plows are out there doing 25 miles an hour, so they're moving roadblocks, so to speak. They're going very slow when they're doing winter operations. So, you know, they are a hazard out there. And if you come on them very fast and can't slow down in time, you know, it could be detrimental to everybody.
We'll definitely talk more about not crowding the plow. Are there times of the day, Todd, that are more dangerous than others, or times of the night?
So we have about 1.3 to 1.4 operators per truck. A normal plow operator's time frame is about 16 hours. They work about 16 hours a day, and then we want to send them home for their safety and the safety of others to get some rest. So with the 1.3 to 1.4, night times we stretch out routes. We go to more of a skeleton crew or reduced staffing. But that means that some roads may not see a truck on it for hours at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So between the hours of about 9 p.m. and 3 to 4 a.m., depending on where you are, and you may not see a truck out there. So there's less volume of vehicles out there. We've reduced at night and, again, stretched out some of the routes. So, again, those hour-and-a-half to two-hour routes may be 3 to 4 hours or more, depending on what happens.
And, Todd, how about the time of the winter when things really ramp up? What are, like, the real hot zone for you and your crews?
I think the biggest thing is the balance of, the employees. We have some of the most dedicated employees, and I would put them against a lot of other places. I mean, they are out there for all the right reasons. They take pride in what they do. They're out there making the road safer for everybody, all of our customers, everybody who's out there driving. And they do take pride in it. They take it very, very seriously. And if they have long hours, it's hard to get them out of the truck home to rest because they're usually so ramped up. They're working on adrenaline and they're so driven to do the right thing that they have a hard time unwinding. And getting some rest and then coming back in. So, if we have durations of long duration storms or one storm after another, that fatigue factor really does set in. And with limited amounts of spare drivers, it makes it very difficult for everybody.
And let's take a call from Patty, who's calling from Faceton. Good morning, Patty. Go right ahead.
Good morning. So I learned a tip a long time ago, and I think it's probably saved my life more than once, to not use cruise control during foul weather, rain, or you never know when you're going to hit an ice patch because the wheels keep turning and you can't stop. So that's just my little tip.
And Todd, I believe you mentioned that too, not to use cruise control. And I think I'm guilty of this. I love using it, but sometimes in the winter I probably should not be. So explain to people why cruise control is a bad idea, in these, winter weather stretches.
So yeah, I fully agree. And that's something my dad taught me a long time ago. Don't use cruise control. Cruise control wasn't as common as it is now.
Right.
About on every vehicle, but. The biggest issue is, as Patty pointed out, your tires keep spinning and they spin at the same speed. They try to keep you to the same speed. Sometimes you accelerate and decelerate. And if the roads are either wet or snow covered or icy, it compromises your traction. So of course you're going to lose control of the vehicle and it's going to keep trying to speed up. Once you lose traction, and as my dad said, even with four wheel drive, if four wheels are spinning, my dad was a mechanic for almost 40 years. So if all four wheels are spinning, you lost track and you're gone. So, he instilled that in me very early in my driving career.
All right. Well, you and Patty have now instilled that in me, and I promise I'll knock it off. Even though I'm kind of a slave to it, I do enjoy it. I definitely see where it's a bad, bad idea in these situations. Tracy, let's talk winter tires. Several years ago, V-Trans ran these TV ads with snowplow drivers asking people to put winter tires on. Why are winter tires important?
Well, they're important because their tread pattern is specifically designed for ice and snow. Summer tires are designed more for shedding water. So, and they also have a different composition in the rubber that's used. Winter tires are a little softer because they grip better being softer, whereas summer tires are a little harder to deal with the warm pavement temperatures. So it's really important more because of the tread pattern and the tread depth as well. It's important that the tires, you know, are still have the depth required to kind of address that snow and ice. And when people drive over snow, like before a plow truck gets there, it tends to cause what we call roll down, and that creates an icy situation. But if you have adequate tires, it chews through that and allows you to, you know, maintain control of your vehicle.
Are studded tires necessary in Vermont, Tracy?
They're not necessary. If you have adequate winter tread, they're not necessary. But they do give you an advantage on ice. Certainly, you still want to drive to the conditions if it's an icy condition, but it tends to grip the icy situations a little bit better. And also, if you do have a roll-down condition and you have studded tires, it helps chew that up a little bit more for the next driver and also for you.
Todd, are chains legal on Vermont roads, and when are the best time to use chains?
Well, we use them on our trucks, especially during icing conditions. You know, a lot of our extreme hills, and actually one of our very extreme routes, Route 9, from Bennington over to Brattleboro, we have a chain-up, mandatory chain-up for tractor-trailers. So they're not as common on other vehicles, but yeah, definitely our trucks, a lot of other plow trucks, and then tractor trailers, it's required when we turn on the chain up lights for Route 9.
And then let's talk winter tires in general on four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive vehicles. Still necessary, Todd?
Definitely, definitely, because the harder, as Tracy pointed out, you know, the harder composition in all seasons and summer tires are for durability. You want them to last a longer mileage range. So if you look at winter tires or snow tires, they have a shorter duration expectancy. So, and that's because of that composition. So it does grip better. But even four wheel, you know, as my dad said, if all four wheels are spinning, you still lost control. So you know, those tires are extremely important to what we do, because that grip, you know, if the grip's not there, the vehicle's not either. So,
now, Tracy, we've talked about not using cruise control. We've talked about slowing down around plows. But in general, how important is speed or controlling it when we're driving on the highways in the winter?
It's incredibly important. Speed is the biggest factor in most of our winter accidents. Drive for the conditions. If the speed limit is 65, it doesn't mean you have to go 65. Slow down, and this is why it's important also not to use cruise control. When you're accelerating or decelerating, your foot is on the pedal. You're feeling that car. You're feeling that tire movement. If you start to slip, it gives you that fraction of a second to start taking corrective action before you're out of control, like Todd was saying. So speed is the biggest factor. Drive for the conditions. If it takes 10 minutes extra to get there, at least you're getting there.
Excellent point. Let's take another call. Paul is calling from Moncton. Paul, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint this morning. Go right ahead.
Okay, good morning to all of you. I have a quick question and a comment. The question being, discussed with my wife and I had multiple times. She's always been a fan of putting cars and vehicles into lower gears as they go down hills. I've always been a believer that in doing so, you still have an engine pushing your tires forward when you may not want them to go forward. So it kind of counters your braking. So I've always used neutral, especially if I've got a truck that can put in high four-wheel drive in order to, you know, to put a little restriction on the tires. I'd be curious as to what you guys think about that. And then the comment I would give is this, and a phrase my father used to use: it's not the giddy up that worries me, it's the woe.
Oh, Paul, that your father is brilliant. It's not the giddy up, it's the whoa. So the moving on ice and snow, not necessarily, but trying to get the car stopped as it's hurtling along there is the real tough part. But the question that Paul had about going downhill in ice and snow, lower gears, neutral, who wants to field that one, Tracy or Todd? I'm going to put it.
Todd, I'll let you feel this one.
So I don't like neutral because I do like some natural braking from the engine itself. But the only caveat to that is, you know, if you excessively downshift, it can put you into a skid. So I think it's a balance. It's more of that. You look at our ABS brakes now, and that was put into place so the tires didn't lock up. And that's what you're trying to do is stop the skid and make sure you maintain control of your vehicle. If your tires are skidding, you don't have that control. So, and with neutral, it allows you, especially if you're going down hills, it allows you, the vehicle to continue to pick up speed. So I think it's a balance. And again, it used to be with the old brakes, braking systems without ABS, you pumped your brakes.
Right.
You want the same thing. You want to slow down gradually and then let off so you can maintain control. So I think it's a balance. I'm not a big fan of, I used to drive tractor trailers, so I'm not a big fan of, that's what I picture in my head when I hear neutral.
Yeah.
Is those things in neutral and gravity working with excessive weights, those things are moving at the end of that. So, I like some give from the engine itself, but again, not so it puts you into a skid. So I think it is a balance.
All right, Paul. Well, a little bit more towards the lower gears than the neutral. And your father was darn right. It's not the giddy up. It's the whoa. We're going to take another break. We're learning all there is to know about arriving safely when the weather turns white. You can call us 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 with your thoughts. You can email them to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We'll be back with more of Vermont Viewpoint after this news from CBS.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I moved here from Miami with an Audi TT. So I bought a used Subi station wagon before my first Vermont winter. And that aside, there was still a lot to learn about driving in the winter here, and I'm still learning. But this show is not just for me. Tracy Pack and Todd Law are from the Vermont Agency of Transportation and have great tips on driving safely during a Vermont winter, and they're guiding all of us through that. You can call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 with a question or a driving tip. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tracy, what are the prime conditions for the worst of all winter driving conditions?
Sorry, could you kind of clarify what you asked?
Sure. Sure. Like when, what happens, what needs to happen for us to be kind of facing the worst of driving conditions out on the highway?
We need to be prepared. We need to make sure that our equipment is in good working order, like we talked about before. Our wipers, our tires. We need to leave ourselves extra time because not only are we running into other drivers that are being very cautious, but also plow trucks. We may run into an accident where, rescue personnel are blocking the road and shutting it down for a few minutes. Really, to be prepared, we just need to be prepared. We need to anticipate extra time and to make sure that we have everything in the vehicle to be able to address any situation.
Mm-hmm. Todd Law, are there certain spots on the interstates that are notorious for winter driving mishaps?
Yeah, there's definitely some areas that seem to get we have weather patterns that change throughout the state. A couple of the areas are around Bolton Flats between Waterbury and Richmond. We get storms there that kind of drop in out of nowhere that don't show up on any of the forecasts or any of the weather radars. They drop in and create havoc. Usually it's icing and freezing rain. And honestly, that's the area where we actually have a lot of open area next to the interstates. So we get a lot of drifting and blowing through there that causes some of the havoc. But that's one of the big areas. Then we have some of the higher elevations around Brookfield.
Yep.
On 89 and then up through 91 around Sheffield, just north of St. Johnsbury before you get to Derby. And they call that the heights anyways, but you know, all those higher elevations seem to get weather when there's no place else and really make havoc for everybody who's out on the roadways.
Tracy, you're in the Rutland area, I believe. Are there roads down that way that people should really be cautious when driving in the winter?
Absolutely. We have US 4 in Mendon going over Sherburn Pass where Killington and Pico are. They tend to get a lot of weather very quickly, that doesn't really affect any of the lower lands, like Todd was saying. Also US 4, you know, it's very open. So like, again, like Todd was saying, there's a lot of drifting and a lot of, you know, snow blowing that could change the driving conditions very, very quickly without any notice. Another thing that I do want to point out is areas that are canopied by the trees, they don't get the sun in there as well. And sun is something that we really need to help activate the salt. So sun in traffic. So, you know, just being aware of the area you're driving in. Is there a lot of drifting? Is it wide open and allowing, you know, snow blow? Or is it canopied so that the material that we're using on the road isn't working as well as it would on a more open area? So there's a lot of variables. And just being aware of the conditions, not just of the road, but around you as well, is really important.
All right. And Tracy, what are the right ways to react when your car starts to slide or spin on the roadway?
Decelerate. Don't hit your brake. Don't try to overcorrect. The first thing you want to do is take your foot off the gas. Allow your tires to make that contact with the surface again, which is what happens if you start sliding. Your tires have broke contact. So the best thing to do is to decelerate. And this, was it Paul that asked about control?
Mm-hmm.
Mike told me years ago, of course, when there were a lot more standard vehicles. If you are in a standard, I wouldn't recommend this maybe in an automatic. But if you have a standard and if you start sliding, if you push the clutch in just to stop it, take all power away, it sometimes will allow you to be able to, you know, regain control of the vehicle and then steer out of the situation.
All right, let's take a call from Dick in Waterbury. Dick, you on the air with us? No. Okay, and I think we now lost Todd. So, Dick, you there?
I am, yep.
All right. So while we get Dick on, you'll need to call Todd back, talking to John, and John Wilson will get Todd back on. But, Dick, go right ahead.
Okay. Listening to your discussion there this morning, I had to chuckle a couple times. There's two major things that probably would eliminate 80% of accidents in the wintertime.
All right, let's go.
speed.
Right.
And snow tires.
There we go.
It is so, every day you listen to the radio, particularly a day like today, you see some snow flurries out there, and you hear slide-offs all over the place, traffic accidents all over the place. Just slow down. That would solve many of the problems. It's so frustrating to get...
All right, and it looks like we lost Dick, but his point, Tracy, was certainly well made. Two things that could save 80% of all those accidents during the winter. One, slowing down, so speed, and then the other would be, of course, having snow tires on. Tracy, I don't know if you have statistics on this specifically, but, you know, if you even slowed your speed down by 5 or 10, 15 miles an hour, you know, how much does that improve then your ability to handle what might happen when you hit a snowy or icy spot?
Unbelievably. Even 5 miles per hour, you're slowing your inertia by that much. So you're able to stop that much faster or maintain or regain control that much faster. Even 5-10 miles per hour reduces the likelihood that you will be in an accident. I mean, we've all seen, you know, the SUVs flying by us, you know, it's 70 miles per hour and kicking up the snow and it's drifting and, you know, and then we drive by and a couple of miles later, we see that same SUV on the side of the road. Speed is the biggest factor. I absolutely agree with that. And snow tires, they give you that advantage because they are specifically designed for driving in snow and icy conditions.
So, Todd, let's first talk about the people who operate these vehicles. Tell people about who they are and the work they do.
About 350 dedicated snowplow operators throughout the state. In about 250 to 260 trucks with a few spares in case something goes down. So our operators work at least a 16-hour day during these storms. So they're usually up anywhere from 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning, and they'll usually work, you know, a 16-hour shift and then go home and try to get some rest. And then we have, you know, the rest of that crew come in and pick up where they leave off for overnight hours, et cetera. So, you know, the dedication is unparalleled. You know, and I think we can say that about many of the snowplow operators across the state, no matter if you're doing public roadways or privates, you know, the endurance, the durability, the commitment is just absolutely impeccable. I'm so impressed with all of our operators. They care about what they do. They care about the people that are out on, quote, their roadways. You know, and that's what's so exciting to be in this position, in this job. It's seeing, you know, it's almost an excitement to be out there, to be doing their jobs and being, you know, such a vital part of our mission, which is through excellent customer service, providing for the safe and efficient movement of people and goods. Without this crew, you know, that would just not happen. So they are instrumental in us meeting or sometimes exceeding our mission. So it's just amazing to be part of this and see these people, hear their comments, you know, some of their innovations. You know, they're very innovative people, again, trying to provide for a safe roadway for the people traveling it. It's absolutely amazing to be a part of.
Tracy, let's now talk about how we as drivers should be behaving, the proper etiquette when we're near a snowplow.
So we want to give them adequate distance. Like Todd was saying earlier, we don't want to come up on them quickly because if you aren't able to stop in time, then you're creating a bigger situation than just being late. We also don't want to pass the plow. Like the slogan is, don't crowd the plow. It's so, so important. When you pass the plow, whether you're passing on the left or the right, you're creating a dangerous situation for yourself. It's only going to be a few minutes When Todd talked about the plow route being an hour and a half to 2 hours, that's the entire route. The likelihood of you being behind a plow truck, you know, doing 25 miles per hour for more than a half an hour is pretty unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
So really just give them their space. Take advantage of the fact that you're driving on roads that have just been cleaned off and material has been applied, and it's you driving on that material is creating a safer condition for the cars behind you. Also, if you pass the plow, now you're driving in a road that has not been cleaned or treated. So that creates a more dangerous situation for the driver.
Hey, let's take another call. Judy is joining us this morning on Vermont Viewpoint. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. I just went through a snow squall in Williston, and one thing I want to comment on is that drivers need to put their lights on.
Mm.
Sometimes you can't see them, and it makes it easier for the other guy to see you. The other thing is, after a snowstorm, people need to take the time to clean their entire car off, because as they're going down the road, they're blowing snow back at you. And in particular, tractor trailers, you need to stay back because they've got stuff on top that obviously they can't reach. And now I'm almost in Burlington where the snow squall has gone through, and the roads look a little glary, so really slow down.
All right.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Judy, those are all good tips, and I'll repeat them for everybody. First of all, think about the other cars who are out there, and you're not spotting them because their lights aren't on. So put your lights on, clean your entire car because of what can be blowing off the person behind you. And the last point, Todd, she says stay back from tractor trailers, but the idea of being close to other cars, not a great idea. We're supposed to, leave that so many car distances between us and the car in front of us on dry pavements, but on icy or snowy pavements, even more important, right?
Definitely, yeah. Your stopping distance increases exponentially, especially because you lose friction. The other piece of it is the reaction time. Other cars may have to make evasive moves if somebody's sliding or whatever. So, sometimes it's very unpredictable. So, yeah, she's definitely right. And honestly, a lot of these points are absolutely on point and excellent. Clean your vehicle off. It'll cause a whiteout condition for people behind you and potentially yourself. If you stop and, you got that big pile of snow on your roof, it could blind you, and you'll be sitting at an intersection with half a foot of snow and not being able to move anywhere, not be able to see. So, these are all excellent points that our callers are bringing up.
Let's take another call from Nils in Duxbury. I think we had him earlier and lost him. Nils, thanks for calling back. Thanks for being persistent. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hopefully you can hear me okay. I'm on my mobile.
Very well. Thanks.
And I've been listening to this great show. Thanks for taking the call. I've been listening intermittently, and this may have already been brought up, but my pet peeve about winter driving stupidity or not being careful
mm-hmm.
is that, four-wheel drive cars and all-wheel drive cars, you watch these ads on television and the car is zooming up the road and there's snow blowing everywhere and Mr. and Mrs. Jones are just like, smiles on their face and... they shot that piece of film at, 10 below zero up in the Rockies somewhere. The truth, though, is that all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive definitely helps you with motive traction, but it really doesn't do anything for steering traction and stopping traction. So if you're new to that system and you're new to winter driving, you get the sense right away, you put your foot on the gas and you go. But... when it's time to turn or stop, you might as well be driving your old two-wheel drive station wagon. And I think this explains the fellow called earlier about snow tires and also going slower. I think this is a lot of the reason why the median between White River and Barrie on a snowy day on a weekend is full of people on their roofs and on their sides. So that's all I really wanted to say. I think the car industry, God bless them, should be a little bit more responsible about this stuff, because it's not fair to tell someone, yep, you can go.
Hey, Nels, I'm going to cut you off right there. I want to get Tracy's input on this. Excellent point. It's like somebody said earlier, it's not the giddy up, it's the woe. But Tracy, you know, when someone hits a bit of snow or a bit of ice and starts to skid, you know, what should the driver be doing?
So the first thing they should be doing is decelerating. Take their foot off the gas. Try to make that contact with the pavement or going through the snow again. And just really being aware of their speed and the situation. And like I said earlier, really being aware of your environment. You know, you could be driving down a road and go into a section of road that is heavily canopied, and so it's not getting sun in there. And that'll change the driving conditions immediately. It's not having the same chemical reactions that straight of way that is all open is having. So, you know, speed is the biggest factor. Be aware of your surroundings and the road conditions.
And Todd, we only have about a minute left, but what is being applied to our roadways by your trucks out there?
So the main material that we use for de-icing is road salt. So it's sodium chloride, much like the stuff that's on your table, just not as refined, not as clean. We also mix that same road salt with water, and it's sometimes referred to as brine. We call it liquid sodium chloride or liquid salt. It enables the salt to work immediately, because for salt to start melting, it has to have moisture. So it's 23.3% salt to water. And then if the temperatures are really cold, we use a liquid magnesium chloride that works to lower temperatures even below zero. And that enables us to use less salt and get the same level of service. Because if we use straight sodium chloride, we need a lot more to try to de-ice at those colder temperatures, because it really loses a lot of its effectiveness. And then we use sand if it's just for traction. And a lot of times, you know, sand has no melting capabilities except for whatever it absorbs from the sun, but it does give a little bit of traction. So, you know, we do use that when the temperatures dictate.
That's Todd Law, and he's the director of the Maintenance Bureau for V-Trans. We're also speaking with Tracy Pack, General Maintenance Manager. Thank you both so much for this hour. If one person is a better winter driver today because of this, it will have well been worth it. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much for having us.
All right, take care. Just before 10, we'll be back after this CBS News break for our next segment.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Since the pandemic took hold in March, one of the hardest hit business sectors in Vermont has been restaurants. Gathering restrictions made dining in impossible for months, and high unemployment rate has meant not as many folks can afford to eat out or get delivery. At the same time, hunger and food insecurity is rising in Vermont. Well, luckily for everyone involved in the cooking and eating of Vermont cuisine, our next guest is part of an effort that pairs hungry Vermonters with free restaurant-cooked meals and uses federal aid to pay those restaurants and keep business moving. The program is called Vermont Everyone Eats, and Dan White is co-founder of the social impact commerce company Localvore. The company has used its app, Localvore Passport, to roll out this new program. Dan White, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be here.
All right, great. And our numbers here, if you want to join the conversation, are 244-1777, also 877-291-8255. If you'd like to ask Dan about Vermont Everyone Eats, or if you've seen its benefits, you can call or you can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Dan, for starters, lots of people hear the word locavore, think of somebody who eats local food, but it's actually the name of your organization, founded back in 2012. Give us some background on what your company does.
Yeah, that's right. We started in 2012 actually as a daily deal business where we would sell a digital voucher for half off and split the revenue with the restaurant. And the whole concept of locavore is to basically use technology to strengthen local economies by connecting conscientious consumers to local businesses. We pivoted our business model in 2018 to the Locavore Passport app, which is actually a consumer subscription model where businesses can actually use the platform for free. We don't charge local businesses anything. There's no fee. There's no contract. And essentially, consumers can become sustaining members for $4.95 a month or $49 a year. And what that gets them is exclusive offers that the restaurants create or the businesses create. So we like to think that we like to say that we're creating purposeful technology.
Yeah. What is the mission of Locavore?
The mission is to strengthen local food systems and to keep the economics of a consumer's dollar, flowing as much as it can in their community. So, you know, when you're eating local food and you're buying or you're dining out at a restaurant that sources locally or supports a nonprofit or several in the community, that's the best use of your dollar as a consumer. So we make it, more affordable and accessible for consumers to do that.
And give me an example of, someone using Locavore, again, before use of Vermont Everyone Eats, of a discount that somebody would get from a restaurant.
Sure. So, a couple of our best partners in Burlington, Vermont would be a Single Pebble, mm-hmm. Which is a farm-to-table Chinese restaurant. Chuho Sampson is an active supporter of the arts, so Flynn Theater, Vermont International Film Festival. She's also been a big supporter of Vermont Works for Women. So we've had offers like $20 off dinner at a Single Pebble. So if you're a subscriber paying $5 a month, you can save $20 and make up the cost of the subscription right there. And what we like to do is highlight the stories and the things that a business owner like Chuho is doing, where she's sourcing from local farms, like at the Intervale Center. She's supporting local nonprofits and creating positive change for the community.
And before COVID,
the point is it's more than a deal. And our app is more than a deals app.
Yeah.
It actually has a directory where you can, you can use Locavore instead of a Yelp or a TripAdvisor in Vermont, and search and locate what you're actually looking for. And then there's a news feed, which is our social feed, where you can post that, content about what businesses are doing. So it's more than a way. We like to say discover, engage, and save, because it's an all-inclusive platform for the local businesses.
And how many people are using the app?
Well, we've had, you know, in our history, we've had over 20,000 Vermonters spend close to $5 million buying local on our platforms. Just last week, you know, with the success of Everyone Eats, we saw over 1,000 daily active users, and there's about 3,000 people using the app just for Everyone Eats.
All right, yeah, let's get into that. Vermont Everyone Eats. Talk me through what you've done with the app since September when you started working with that project.
Yeah, so we created a web form, which is where people who've been impacted by COVID can actually sign up and create a username and password for the app. So if you go to www.everyoneeatsvt.com, you can create a username and password. And then when you actually download the app, Local Board Passport, and log in, there's no subscription process. And it, instead of the typical offers that you'd see, we kind of co-branded the app with the Everyone Eats logo and icon. And we're using our same kind of digital voucher system to showcase the meals that you can access for free right on the app. So it's almost like we, you know, white labeled the app. To a degree where it's still Local Board Passport, but it's a different view and a different experience when you're looking at the meals, and the redemption flow is what's very similar, and that's why we were able to so quickly, you know, take this from an idea to an opportunity.
And before you got involved, Everyone Eats was going. So give us a little background on, you know, that program and exactly what that's all about so people understand that.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been partners with the Skinny Pancake since inception when we first started Local War. And when they created shift meals back in the spring during the first shutdown, you know, we were supporting that effort back then, and we were really excited because it was a great model that they created. And then over the summer in August, they reached out to us, the Shift Meals folks and the Skinny Pancake folks, and said, hey, you know, we want to expand the program and get beyond just the distribution events so that restaurants can benefit more holistically. So they needed a digital voucher system, and their first thought was Local War because they were already familiar with using Local War for the Skinny Pancake in the traditional Local War Passport model. So, you know, we got the contract and the green light to start working on this new system in early September, and by October, you know, the second week of October, we had a working product, and the first users and restaurants were taking advantage of it.
That's excellent. Dan White of Localvore is here to tell us about Vermont Everyone Eats. Dan, give us that website again.
Yeah, so it's www.everyoneeatsvt.com.
All right.
And that's where you can go on and create a username and password. If you have a household of more than just yourself and you want to pick up meals for, you know, you and your kids or your partner, you can actually sign up to get up to 10 meals at a time. Mm. Some folks are even, you know, getting meals for their parents who are elderly and they can't get out of the house right now. Some people are going to, you know, residential buildings where there's tenants that need support but don't have smartphones. And they're picking up 10 meals at a time to help their neighbors. So you can create an account And then whatever that username and password is you create on everyoneeatsbt.com, that's what you use to log in when you download the app Locavore Passport. And that's how you'll be able to access all the meals. The other thing is it's statewide. You know, we have businesses in Hardwick, Vermont, all the way down to Bennington, and everywhere in between. So it geolocates you, so you'll actually see the restaurants and the meals that are nearest to you by location.
How brilliant. And Dan, first of all, is it really that simple for someone to get involved with this? Do they have to qualify in some way?
You know, it really is that simple because so many people have been impacted by COVID, myself included. You know, I'm a small business owner in Burlington, and I'm not making the same salary I was before. But that's okay because, you know, we're in it for the long haul. And, you know, a lot of people who may think, oh, is this for, you know, people who are technically hungry? You know, the answer is everyone can use a little food assistance right now. And, you know, if you really haven't been and you don't feel like you qualify, that's totally understandable. The reality is, this is also really helpful for the restaurants. They are getting $10 a meal of tax-free revenues. I had a couple restaurant owners yesterday tell me, this is saving our asses, and we would definitely be shut down completely if it weren't for this program. So what I would say is, if you've been impacted by COVID, sign up and use this program at least to help your local restaurant community.
How many restaurants are involved, Dan?
There's probably over 50 right now. And in with the program as a whole, maybe even more because some restaurants are just participating in the Everyone Eats distribution events, which have also been a huge success too.
And how many meals are we talking about, I don't know, on a daily or weekly basis that these restaurants are serving through this program?
Yeah, so this is what's really exciting. And I think that the, you know, the, right now on everyone's mind is let's keep this program going through 2021. Last week alone, we did close to 7,000 meals. The week before that, we did about 3,500. The week before that, you know, it was in the 2000s. So what we're seeing is every week, the volume and the scale is going up, which shows that there is that much demand and there's that many people in restaurants that need the support. So we're excited to see that type of growth and hoping that we can find the funding to keep doing this into the new year, because January, February, and March, which are already difficult months with or without a global pandemic, they're going to be extra difficult this year.
And you mentioned that the restaurants get $10 a meal. I'm just doing the quick math over those last 3 weeks. That means our Vermont restaurants have realized $125,000 that probably would not have come their way. So how do the restaurants actually end up getting paid?
Yeah, so every week we match up our reports based on the redemptions we can see in our database with what the restaurants have to do to send us an invoice and report. And we match those up, make sure that they're all aligned, and then we process a payment each week.
Dan, do people have a run of the menu? Are there certain specific meal packages to choose from when they go to the website, to the app, and want to order?
Yeah, so when a restaurant signs up, they have to follow some basic guidelines that the program acquires for nutritional value in the meals. And then they also have to have at least 10% local ingredients. And so you know, the restaurants will create one or multiple meal options. We'll copy and paste that description, add a photo to the app, give some basic ordering and redemption instructions, and that's pretty much it.
Dan, you've seen this from both sides. What has been the impact on the local restaurants so far through this?
Well, I would say that with the recent restrictions to one household, we saw a ton of restaurants immediately just say, we're going to shut down until this is all said and done with.
Mm-hmm.
The way our digital voucher program works with Everyone Eats is it is call ahead to pick up. So we're not really sending folks in to dine in. So it works really well regardless of how heavy the restrictions are. And so with the recent restrictions, this program is making it's even more vital that restaurants use this program. So I just can't say enough about even in the past 2 weeks, how much of an impact we're seeing it have. It's really great.
Now, have restaurants been able to keep employees on because this program's in existence? Is that what you've been seeing? And even feeding?
Oh, yeah, 100%. So, you know, we're doing some other stimulus programs with our app and business for the Restart Vermont grant money. I don't know if you've heard of Restart Vermont, but it's another program through the ACCD to do marketing to help local businesses. And so one of the restaurants we're working with is Pizzeria Veritas.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, you know, they're participating with us in the Restart Vermont programming. And they called us up last week and said, you know, I've got one employee I really want to keep on board. And, you know, that I think if we do Everyone Eats, I'll be able to do that. So absolutely, that is top of mind for the restaurant owners, is keeping their valued staff members. And, hey, look, if you can move 200 meals a week for 4 weeks in a row, you're going to be able to employ more than a couple employees.
Love Pizzeria Verita there in Burlington. Excellent pizza, one of the great pizza makers here in the state. So well done in helping them. So, Dan, will people be able to do this with the app in January, or is that up to the folks in Washington?
You know, that's kind of the question. I think, my guess is that we're all waiting to see what happens this week at the state level, you know, with the federal government, and whether there's going to be a new stimulus or not. I just think that regardless, we've got to figure out a way to keep doing it on our own.
Mm-hmm.
It's that critical. And I think that there is a light at the end of the tunnel here. I think with what we're hearing about the vaccine coming out and, you know, that it is going to take a certain amount of time. Let's look at it this way. We just have to get through Q1. So frankly, whether the federal government comes through or not, I think we're united and we're strong enough here in Vermont as a community to figure out how to put more money on the table for this program.
Is this being rolled out in other states that you know of, Dan?
You know, I haven't seen anything quite like it. However, we have business partners in the Twin Cities, and they're paying attention. People are watching this program from different states and cities. I actually spoke to a couple chambers of commerce in Chicago where I grew up because I just wanted to let them know how successful this program is. And, you know, if you take a step back, even though it's really tough everywhere and here, you know, Chicago and Minnesota have been completely shut down. So, you know, these are places, I actually reached out to someone in New York City to let them know about this program, because this is a program that should go on in other places. And I think that, you know, that's the type of thing that we can be proud of as Vermonters, is that we start small, but we can create big change.
Dan, let's give that website one more time where people can download the app for Vermont Everybody Eats. Everyone Eats.
Yeah, so go to www.everyoneeatsvt.com, create an account, and then go to Localvore Passport in the iPhone or Android store, download the app, and log in, and help everyone in the community.
All right, Dan, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. This show has a goal of keeping you informed from Montpelier to Washington, from your neighborhood to our community. And as part of that mission, I want to make sure that you know what people like Dan White, our previous guest, is doing, and organizations like the Central Vermont Council on Aging is doing. That's our next guest, here to give us a glimpse into the work they do for older Vermonters in 54 Central Vermont towns is their Director of Development and Communications, Mary Hayden. Mary, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Listeners, if you have questions about the council or if you've seen their work in action, you can call us at 244-1777, also 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mary, tell me about the work that the organization does.
Central Vermont Council on Aging provides non-medical supports and community-based supports for older Central Vermonters. Our main mission is to enable older Vermonters to be able to stay in their homes and communities if that's what they desire to do. And most do want to do that. So there's a wide range of services, but to give you some idea specifically, our case managers coordinate establish and coordinate long-term care plans for our older clients to enable them to be able to stay at home. And that involves, say, qualifying them for benefits, evaluating their situation, bringing to the picture services such as Meals on Wheels or supports for family caregivers who are taking care of, say, a loved one with dementia. We provide Medicare counseling for folks who need to resolve an issue or a problem with Medicare, or who may be new to Medicare or are re-enrolling in their Medicare prescription drug program every year. We also connect folks to mental health clinicians if that's needed, or to legal aid resources if they have legal issues. We also have a very robust volunteer program. So we recruit and screen and train and supervise a great cadre of volunteers who also help to provide the same kinds of services in the community for older Vermonters to help them to be able to stay in the community that they love, in the home that they love.
Mary, when did the work of the council get started?
Well, it's been a while. We celebrate our 40th anniversary this year, actually.
Wow. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, thank you. We unfortunately had to cancel our gala. due to the pandemic. But yeah, so it's been a year of celebrating four decades of work in this area for us.
Oh, but that 41st anniversary gala is going to be a big one. And that's a prime number, no less. So
there you go. All right. Yeah.
Hey, I mentioned 54 towns in central Vermont, and I know you've got them all memorized alphabetically and geographically. But without listing them all, how much of an area do you cover?
Well, in central Vermont, geographically, I think that's a large area because it's covering all of Lamoille County and Orange County and Washington County. And in those 54 towns, we also cover a few towns that are also in Windsor County. And we also cover, I think, one town in Addison and one town in Rutland County. So it's all those three counties plus eight more.
That's massive. You took in a few strays. Just didn't have enough work, did you, Mary?
That's exactly right, apparently.
And who qualifies for the services that you provide?
Right. So most of our services under what's called the Federal Older Americans Act are for people who are 60 and older. We are allowed to provide services to some adults who are under 60 if they have a disability, for example. But 60 and older is really the main population that we're serving in that area.
And how is the program supported financially?
Financially, most of our funding is coming from governmental funds, such as the federal government, and again, the Older Americans Act, and some other federal sources come into play there. Also, the state of Vermont budget. We are fortunate to receive support annually from our towns through the town funding appropriation process, and then some portion may be in any... Recently, more like 8 to 10% of our funding is coming from private donations and foundations.
So people can make individual contributions to the council?
They absolutely can.
And we encourage it. Not going to turn that down, I take it.
I don't think so. We are we are actually engaged right now. I believe our letter goes out today. So it's excellent timing to state that folks certainly can make a difference.
I'm all about timing. So if people aren't receiving a letter asking to contribute but are listening now and would like to, how do they go about that, Mary?
Certainly, I think the most convenient way to do that is through our website. Just go to, cvcoa.org and then find the donate button, and it'll take you right to the donation page.
Give me an example or two of how CVCOA got involved to help one of your clients or some of your clients.
Yeah, I've worked here about 5 years, and one letter I received just always touched me and resonated with me, which was from a couple who had been married for 60 years. They were in their 80s. They had lived together that entire time, and the wife started really going downhill health-wise, and the husband had become really a 24/7, full-time caregiver for her, and things were getting really difficult. We were brought into the picture. That's typically through a referral, often from a healthcare provider, for example, and we looked at the situation, and we got the wife qualified for benefits so she could go into a residential care, but they weren't allowed to be together anymore, and they weren't in their home together anymore. But she stabilized and did well, and our team here, which I think is typical of them, their creative problem solving is really amazing. They found a way to bring her home, bring services into the home, and that's several years ago, and they are still together living in their home with services, but they're able to stay in the home that they love and the community in Vermont that they grew up in and that they love. So I think that's really the penultimate example of what we bring to the table.
Give us, you mentioned a number of things, the services you provide. So why don't you parse out, maybe a specific example where you do provide services to your the people that you do serve.
Yeah, I mean, for example, I guess one of the most obvious this year is what's happened during the pandemic. So we have had to very, very quickly, we had to really pivot to serve our clients in a very different way. And that meant our basic model of having a lot of in-person contact with our clients, either in their homes or here at our office, had to change. So we have pivoted to providing a lot of our, say, educational classes and our wellness work remotely where possible through Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
We contact people by phone. And additionally, we now have a new position that we created that will deal with, specifically deal with keeping older persons connected and trying to reduce the isolation and loneliness that was already a problem for many older people, but is become a significant problem. And I don't even know if we know how much of a problem yet under the COVID crisis. So, you know, for example, we have now set up a program under an AARP seed grant to connect older Vermonters through an art project to volunteers who help them with their project remotely, you know, show them how to do their project, and then either Zoom with them regularly to talk about it and connect about it, or talk with them on the phone. So we're trying to find creative ways to keep older Vermonters connected socially, because it really is a huge health risk if we have so many isolated older people out there.
And how old, are your clients doing, these older Vermonters, adapting to things like Zoom?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty interesting. I think we've had to adjust our own thinking, our own cultural biases about how older people use technology and their ability to use technology. We've had an enormous response, for example, to people participating in our Medicare classes by Zoom. So we feel we're still reaching people to help them enroll in Medicare. We've had, like through, for example, the art project I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
we've had, it kind of incentivizes some people to want to say, gee, I'd like to learn how to use my phone, my smartphone or my device to connect on Zoom or in some other way. So I think we have to approach it on a case-by-case or individual basis to assess where someone's at. And the other big issue is how can we bring resources to the table to get people who can't afford to be connected to the Internet, who can't necessarily afford a device, and who need the support, like we all do from time to time, tech support, to be able to maintain those connections. So part of the new position here and part of our statewide aging network efforts are to figure out how we leverage those resources from the private sector, from governmental resources. Obviously, it connects to an ongoing issue we've had in the state of Vermont and elsewhere in the country where rural connectivity to the Internet is challenging. So hopefully, we are pivoting to technology in a way that will benefit more people for the long run, not just temporarily.
Outstanding.
And I also want to say that it's not, we don't want to pretend it's the solution to everything. People do need that human contact.
This is true. And we'll have that in the future at some point. Mary, Meals on Wheels comes under your purview. How much has that been impacted by the pandemic?
Yeah, it's been I'm so glad you asked that, because it's been a major focus for us since we all went into sort of our lockdown mode back in March and April. So very quickly, we had to pivot from, first of all, we couldn't provide any more community meals to folks. So again, that social connection being lost plus the nutritional part of it. We qualified many more people to receive home-delivered or Meals on Wheels as a result of the pandemic. So we had to very quickly find resources. Fortunately, the Vermont Community Foundation, as well as Meals on Wheels of America, provided emergency assistance through grants to us. And that allowed us to buy 10,000 frozen or what we call shelf-ready meals that we could get out to folks really quickly, but also deliver them and make less trips. We had to come up with a contactless protocol for delivering those meals, and we also had to find resources to buy the PPE for the people who prepare the meals at our meal sites, as well as all of the volunteers, drivers who deliver the meals. So it's been an enormous effort. I think our nutrition team here and all the meal sites in central Vermont have just been amazing and have faced this crisis and come out, you know, very well. We don't currently have anyone that I'm aware of on a waiting list for Meals on Wheels home-delivered meals. And hopefully when things are back to normal, we can resume those community meals, which we're providing a lot of social interaction and contact for people as well.
Is there still funding coming from the federal government for your Meals on Wheels program?
Well, I believe that it's scheduled to be spent. A lot of the spending has to be exhausted, I believe, by the end of the current year that the state provided to us. And then, but back in the spring, I guess late winter and spring, we also received funding under CARES Act and Family First Act to continue to serve so many more people. And, you know, we already needed more funds before the crisis, and we already needed to provide more home-delivered meals to folks who qualify for it. So those funds are going to cover that, the expenses incurred due to the pandemic, but ongoing, we're going to need to continue to have those resources to serve folks. We don't expect a lot of folks now new to the Meals on Wheels program to suddenly not need those meals anymore because their nutritional needs are being met.
So that demand that has increased will remain high afterwards, is what you're saying.
We're evaluating that very closely as a state, and it appears so. It appears so.
You mentioned earlier the isolation that COVID has brought on to these older Vermonters. I've seen it with my own mom, the effects that it can have. Talk a little bit about this and how you're helping people cope with that.
Right. It was an issue we were really focused on before the onset of the pandemic because, and I'm not a medical expert, but my understanding is that loneliness and isolation in the older population actually has pretty serious health consequences for folks. It can diminish their health in many ways. So we were really focused on how to prevent that and avoid that and kind of diminish those impacts for folks prior to COVID. But with so many people now unable to see people the way they used to or go out to places the way they used to, as I said earlier, I think the health impact of this longer term is not necessarily even known yet to the country, let alone in Vermont. But as I said, we stood up this new position here at Central Vermont Council on Aging to really focus bring focus just to this issue. So we are, part of that is doing a lot of research on new and better ways to reach people. Again, bringing resources to the table to connect people to, whether that's through technology or some other means. But I think it's going to be a health issue that we will all be talking about in the medium and long term.
Mary, we only have about a minute left, but do you have a need for volunteers? And, who would be the right type of volunteer? What would they, enjoy about this?
Yeah, I mean, we always do. And I think our volunteers, they love working with and, you know, frankly, hanging out with older people, right? And they can be, you know, of any age of adult who just really enjoys spending time with older people. So if you are interested in doing that and giving back in that way, our program, as I said, offers a way for our volunteers to work very directly with our older population. Our volunteers are part of the mission and delivering the mission here at Central Vermont Council on Aging, which is to help people to be able to stay at home safely if they can.
And how would someone get involved if they wanted to volunteer for y'all?
Well, again, I go back to cvcoa.org. We have great buttons right on our homepage that say, like, how can I help? And click on that button, and you get right to an information page as well as an online application. Or if you don't like online applications, there's someone you can email or call who can send you the application through the mail or talk to you and connect with you before you apply.
And who's a typical volunteer that gets involved with y'all?
Typical. I mean, really, they're from all walks of life. I mean, they need to be an adult. They need to be at least 18.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they tend to be people who want to get involved in their community, who want to volunteer in some respect in their community, but they're also looking for a volunteer opportunity that affords them that direct, you know, personal contact with people. So they're the kind of people that like to take someone out grocery shopping in normal times, obviously,
right.
Or like to hang out with someone and provide respite for a caregiver, or are going to, you know, just be there and spend time and provide companionship to someone. So I think it's people who really like other people and especially want to connect with older people.
Mary Hayden is the Director of Development and Communication for the Central Vermont Council on Aging. You can check out the work they do and support their efforts at cvcoa.org. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Lee Cattell and John Wilson. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference follows CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri. I'm off for the next 3 days. Jim Douglas, that's right, the Governor, will be your host and maybe guest tomorrow here on Vermont Viewpoint.